In 1973, a book was published entitled Les Dessous d'une Ambition Politique, The Undercurrents of a Political Ambition. This book, written by a Swiss journalist named Mathieu Paoli, recounts the author's exhaustive attempts to investigate the Prairie-des-Sions. Like us, Monsieur Paoli eventually established contact with a representative of the order, whom he does not identify by name. But Monsieur Paoli did not have the prestige of the BBC behind him, and the representative he met would seem to have been of lesser status than Monsieur Plantard. Nor was his representative as communicative as Monsieur Plantard was with us. At the same time, Monsieur Paoli, being based on the continent, was able to pursue certain leads and undertake on-the-spot research in a way that we could not. As a result, his book was extremely valuable and contains much new information, so much, in fact, that it appears to warrant a sequel, and we wondered why Monsieur Paoli had not written one. When we inquired about him, we were told that in 1977 or 1978, he had been shot as a spy by the Israeli government for attempting to sell secrets to the Arabs. In the Versailles annex of the Bibliothèque Nationale, Monsieur Paoli discovered 4 issues of Circuit, the magazine mentioned in the Prairie-des-Sions statutes. The first one was dated July 1, 1959, and its director was listed as Pierre Plantard. But the magazine itself did not purport to be connected with the Prairie-des-Sions. On the contrary, it declared itself the official organ of something called the Federation of French Forces. There was an address listed in Aulnay-sous-Bois and a telephone number. Monsieur Paoli checked the address. No magazine had ever been published there. The telephone number, too, proved to be false, and all Monsieur Paoli's attempts to track the Federation of French Forces proved futile. To this day, no information on any such organization has been forthcoming. But it would hardly seem coincidental that the French headquarters of the Committees of Public Safety were also Aulnay-sous-Bois. The Federation of French Forces would thus appear to have been in some way connected with the committees. Monsieur Paoli reports that Volume 2 of Circuit alludes to a letter from de Gaulle to Pierre Plantard thanking the latter for his service. The service in question would seem to have been the work of the Committees of Public Safety. According to Monsieur Paoli, most of the articles in Circuit... Monsieur Paoli reports that Volume 2 of Circuit alludes to a letter from de Gaulle to Pierre Plantard thanking the latter for his service. The service in question would seem to have been the work of the Committees of Public Safety. According to Monsieur Paoli, most of the articles in Circuit dealt with esoteric matters. However, there were other articles of a very different kind. Some of them spoke of a secret science of vines and viticulture, the grafting of vines, which apparently had some crucial bearing on politics. This seemed to make no sense, unless we assumed that vines and viticulture were to be understood allegorically, a metaphor perhaps for family trees and dynastic alliances. When the articles in Circuit were not arcane or obscure, they were, according to Monsieur Paoli, fervently nationalistic. From Volume 4, Monsieur Paoli quotes the following passage. "We desired that the 1,500 copies of Circuit be a contact which kindles a light. We desired that the voice of patriots be able to transcend obstacles as in 1940, when they left invaded France to come and knock on the office door of the leader of Free France. Today, it is the same. Before all, we are French. We are that force which fights in one way or another to construct a France cleansed and new. This must be done in the same patriotic spirit, with the same will and solidarity of action. Thus we cite here what we declare to be an old philosophy." Then there follows a detailed plan of government to restore to France a lost luster. The plan is not inordinately controversial and could probably be instituted with a minimum of upheaval. Nor can the plan be labelled politically. It can't be called left-wing or right-wing, liberal or conservative, radical or reactionary. On the whole, it seems fairly innocuous, and one is at a loss to see how it would necessarily restore any particular lost luster to France. As Monsieur Paoli says, the propositions are not revolutionary. However, They rest on a realistic analysis of the actual structures of the French state, and are impregnated with a solid good sense. But then the plan of government outlined in Circuit makes no explicit mention of the real basis on which it would presumably rest, the restoration of a popular monarchy ruled by the Merovingian bloodline. In Circuit, there would be no need to state this, for it would constitute an underlying given, a premise on which everything published in the magazine pivoted. Having conducted extensive research, Monsieur Parly is satisfied with the Merovingian claim to legitimacy. To that extent, he admits he can make sense of Sion's objectives. Beyond this point, however, he confesses himself to be profoundly puzzled. What is the point, he wonders, of restoring the Merovingian bloodline? Would a modern-day Merovingian regime be different from any other modern-day regime? What is so special about the Merovingians? Why should so many powerful and intelligent people, both today and in the past, accord it not only their attention, but their allegiance as well? We, of course, were posing precisely the same questions. It seemed to make no sense. Unless, of course, we were overlooking something. Unless legitimacy was not the only Merovingian claim. Unless there was something else of immense consequence that differentiated the Merovingians from other dynasties. Unless there was something very special indeed about the Merovingian blood royal. We encountered a number of enigmas surrounding the origins of the Merovingian dynasty. One usually thinks of a dynasty, for example, as a ruling family or house which not merely succeeds another ruling family or house, but does so by virtue of having displaced, deposed, or supplanted its predecessors. In the case of the Merovingians, however, there was no such violent or abrupt transition. On the contrary, the house that came to be called Merovingian seems already to have ruled over the Franks. The Merovingians were already rightful and duly acknowledged kings, but there appears to have been something special about one of them, so much so that he conferred his name on the entire dynasty. The ruler for whom the Merovingians derived their name is most elusive, his historical reality eclipsed by legend. Merovée was a semi-supernatural figure worthy of classical myth. Even his name bears witness to his miraculous origin and character. It echoes the French word for mother, as well as both French and Latin words for sea. According to both the leading Frankish chronicler and to subsequent tradition, Merovée was born of two fathers. When already pregnant by her husband, King Clodio, Merovée's mother supposedly went swimming in the ocean. In the water, she is said to have been seduced and or raped by an unidentified marine creature from beyond the sea. This creature apparently impregnated the lady a second time. And when Merovée was born, there allegedly flowed in his veins a commingling of two different bloods, the blood of a Frankish ruler and of a mysterious aquatic creature. Such fantastic legends are quite common, of course. Usually they're symbolic or allegorical, masking some concrete historical fact behind their fabulous facade. In the case of Merovée, it might well indicate an intermarriage of some sort, or a mingling of dynastic lines, whereby the Franks became allied by blood with someone else, quite possibly with a source from beyond the sea, a source which, for one or another reason, was transformed by subsequent fable into a sea creature. In any case, by virtue of his dual blood, Merovée was said to have been endowed with an impressive array of superhuman powers. According to tradition, Merovingian monarchs were occult adepts, initiates in arcane sciences, practitioners of esoteric arts. They were often called the sorcerer kings. By virtue of some miraculous property in their blood, they could allegedly heal by laying on of hands, and according to one account, the tassels at the fringes of their robes were deemed to possess miraculous curative powers. They were said to be capable of clairvoyant or telepathic communication with beasts and with the natural world around them, and to wear a powerful magical necklace. They were said to possess an arcane spell which protected them and granted them phenomenal longevity, which history does not seem to confirm. They all supposedly bore a distinctive birthmark, which rendered them immediately identifiable and which attested to their semi-divine or sacred blood. This birthmark reputedly took the form of a red cross, either over the heart or between the shoulder blades. The Merovingians were also frequently called the long-haired kings. Like Samson in the Old Testament, their hair supposedly contained their vertu, the essence and secret of their power. They were not regarded as kings in the modern sense of that word. They were regarded as priest-kings, embodiments of the divine, not unlike the ancient Egyptian pharaohs. They did not rule simply by God's grace. On the contrary, they were apparently deemed the living embodiment and inarcation of God's grace, a status usually reserved exclusively for Jesus. And they seem to have engaged in ritual practices which partook, if anything, more of priesthood than of kingship. Skulls found of Merovingian monarchs, for example, bear what appears to be a ritual incision or hole in the crown. Similar incisions can be found in the skulls of high priests of early Tibetan Buddhism, to allow the soul to escape on death and to open direct contact with the divine. In 1653, an important Merovingian tomb was found in the Ardennes, the tomb of King Childeric I, son of Merovè. The tomb contains arms, treasure, and regalia, such as one would expect to find in a royal tomb. It also contained items of magic, sorcery, and divination, a severed horse's head, a bull's head made of gold, and a crystal ball. One of the most sacred of Merovingian symbols was the bee, and King Childeric's tomb contained no less than 300 miniature bees made of solid gold. Eventually, most of Childeric's treasure was returned to France, and when he was crowned emperor in 1804, Napoleon made a special point of having the golden bees affixed to his coronation robes. This incident was not the only manifestation of Napoleon's interest in the Merovingians. He commissioned a compilation of genealogies by one Abbé Pichon to determine whether or not the Merovingian bloodline had survived the fall of the dynasty. It was on these genealogies that the genealogies in the Prieuré documents were in large part based. We could find little verifiable information about the origins of the Merovingians. They themselves claimed descent from Noah, whom they regarded, even more than Moses, as the source of all biblical wisdom, an interesting position which surfaced again 1,000 years later in European Freemasonry. The Merovingians also claimed direct descent from ancient Troy. Contemporary writers, including the authors of the Prieuré documents, have endeavoured to trace the Merovingians to ancient Greece, and specifically to the region known as Arcadia. According to these documents, the ancestors of the Merovingians were connected with Arcadia's royal house. At some unspecified date towards the advent of the Christian era, they supposedly migrated up the Danube, then up the Rhine, and established themselves in what is now Western Germany. In the early 5th century, the invasion of the Huns provoked large-scale migrations of almost all European tribes. It was at this time that the Merovingians, or more accurately, the Sicambrian ancestors of the Merovingians, crossed the Rhine and moved en masse into Gaul, establishing themselves in what is now Belgium and northern France, in the vicinity of the Ardennes. A century later, this region came to be called the Kingdom of Austrasie, and the core of the Kingdom of Austrasie was what is now known as Lorraine. The Sicambrian influx into Gaul did not consist of a horde of wild, unkempt barbarians tumultuously overrunning the land. On the contrary, it was a placid and civilized affair. For centuries, the Sicambrians had maintained close contact with the Romans, and though they were pagans, they were not savages. Indeed, they were well versed in Roman customs and administration, and followed Roman fashions. Some Sicambrians had become high-ranking officers in the imperial army. Some had even become Roman consuls. Thus, the Sicambrian influx was less an onslaught or an invasion than a kind of peaceful absorption. And when towards the end of the 5th century the Roman Empire collapsed, the Sicambrians filled the vacuum. They did not do so violently or by force. They retained the old customs and altered very little. With no upheaval whatever, they assumed control of the already existing but vacant administrative apparatus. The regime of the early Merovingians thus conformed fairly closely to the model of the old Roman Empire. Our research exhumed mention of at least two historical figures named Merove, and it's not altogether clear which of them legend credits with descent from a sea creature. One Merove was a Sicambrian chieftain, alive in 417, who fought under the Romans and died in 438. In 448, the son of this first Merove, bearing the same name as his father, was proclaimed the king of the Franks at Tournai, and reigned until his death 10 years later. He may have been the first official king of the Franks as a united people. By virtue of this, perhaps, the dynasty which succeeded him has since been called Merovingian. Under Merove's successors, the kingdom of the Franks flourished. It was not the crude, barbaric culture often imagined. They were not like the Vikings, for instance, or the Vandals, Visigoths, or Huns. Their main activities were farming and commerce. Much attention was devoted to maritime trade, especially in the Mediterranean, and the artifacts of the Merovingian epoch reflect a quality of workmanship which is truly amazing, as the Sutton Hoo treasure ship attests. The wealth accumulated by the Merovingian kings was enormous, even by later standards. Much of this wealth was in gold coins of superb quality, produced by royal mints at certain important sites, including what is now Sion in Switzerland. Specimens of such coins were found in the Sutton Hoo treasure ship and can now be seen in the British Museum. Many of the coins bear a distinctive equal-armed cross, identical to the one subsequently adopted during the Crusades for the Frankish Kingdom of Jerusalem. Although Merovingian culture was both temperate and surprisingly modern, the monarchs who presided over it were another matter. The atmosphere of mystery and legend, magic and the supernatural, surrounded them even during their lifetimes. Sons of the Merovingian blood were not created kings. On the contrary, they were automatically regarded as such on the advent of their 12th birthday. There was no public ceremony of anointment, no coronation of any sort. Power was simply assumed as by sacred right. But while the king was supreme authority in the realm, he was never obliged, or even expected, to sully his hands with the mundane business of governing. He was essentially a ritualized figure, a priest-king, and his role was not necessarily to do anything, simply to be. Government and administration was left to a non-royal official, the equivalent of a chancellor, who held the title Mayor of the Palace. Even after their conversion to Christianity, the Merovingian rulers, like the patriarchs of the Old Testament, were polygamous. On occasion, they enjoyed harems of oriental proportions. Even when the aristocracy, under pressure from the church, became rigorously monogamous, the monarchy remained exempt, and the church, curiously enough, seems to have accepted this prerogative without any inordinate protest. The most famous of all Merovingian rulers was Merovee's grandson, Clovis I, who reigned between 481 and 511. Clovis's name is familiar to any French schoolchild, for it was under Clovis that the Franks were converted to Roman Christianity, and it was through Clovis that Rome began to establish her undisputed supremacy in Western Europe, a supremacy that would remain unchallenged for 1,000 years. By 496, the Roman Church was in a precarious situation. Between 384 and 399, the Bishop of Rome had already begun to call himself the Pope, but his official status was no greater than that of any other bishop, and quite different from that of the Pope today. He was not in any sense the spiritual leader or supreme head of Christendom. He merely represented one of many divergent forms of Christianity, and one which was desperately fighting for survival against a multitude of conflicting points of view. Officially, the Roman Church had no greater authority than, say, the Celtic Church, with which it was constantly at odds. If the Roman Church was to survive, it would need the support of a champion, a powerful secular figure who might represent it. If Christianity was to evolve in accordance with Roman doctrine, that doctrine would have to be disseminated, implemented, and imposed by secular force, a force sufficiently powerful to withstand and eventually extirpate the challenge of rival Christian creeds. Not surprisingly, the Roman Church, in its most acute moment of need, turned to Clovis. By 486, Clovis had significantly increased the extent of Merovingian domains, striking out from the Ardennes to annex a number of adjacent kingdoms and principalities, vanquishing a number of rival tribes. Within a decade, it was apparent that Clovis was well on his way to becoming the most powerful potentate in Western Europe. The conversion and baptism of Clovis proved to be of crucial importance to our investigation. An account of it was compiled, in all its particulars and details, around the time it happened. 2.5 centuries later, this account, called The Life of Saint Remy, was destroyed, except for a few scattered manuscript pages. The fragments that survive bear witness to the importance of what was involved. According to tradition, Clovis's conversion was effected by his wife, Clotilde, a fervent devotee of Rome who was subsequently canonized for her efforts. In these efforts, she was said to have been guided and assisted by her confessor, Saint Remy. But behind these traditions, there lies a very practical and mundane historical reality. It is known that in 496, a number of secret meetings occurred between Clovis and Saint Remy. Immediately thereafter, an accord was ratified between Clovis and the Roman Church. For Rome, this accord constituted a major political triumph. It would ensure the Church's survival and establish that Church as supreme spiritual authority in the West. It would consolidate Rome's status as an equal to the Greek Orthodox faith based in Constantinople. It would offer a prospect of Roman hegemony and an effective means of eradicating the Hydra heads of heresy. And Clovis would be the means of implementing these things, the sword of the Church of Rome. In return, Clovis was granted the title of Novus Constantius, New Constantine. In other words, he was to preside over a unified empire, a Holy Roman Empire intended to succeed the one supposedly created under Constantine and destroyed by the Visigoths and the Vandals not long before. The pact between Clovis and the Roman Church was one of momentous consequence to Christendom. Not only the Christendom of the time, but also the Christendom of the next millennium. Clovis's baptism was deemed to mark the birth of a new Roman Empire, a Christian empire based on the Roman Church and administered on the secular level by the Merovingian bloodline. In other words, an indissoluble bond was established between church and state, each pledging allegiance to the other, each binding itself to the other in perpetuity. During the remaining years of his life, Clovis fully realized Rome's ambitious expectations of him. With irresistible efficiency, faith was imposed by the sword, and with the sanction and spiritual mandate of the Church, the Frankish kingdom expanded to both east and south, encompassing most of modern France and much of modern Germany. In 511, Clovis died, and the empire he had created was divided, according to Merovingian custom, between his 4 sons. For more than a century thereafter, the Merovingian dynasty presided over a number of disparate and often warring kingdoms, while lines of succession became increasingly tangled and claims to thrones increasingly confused. Intrigues, machinations, kidnappings, and political assassination became ever more commonplace, and the court chancellors, or mayors of the palace, accumulated more and more power. The constant strife thrust a number of Merovingian princes onto the throne at an extremely youthful age, and they were thus easily manipulated by their advisers. But those who did attain manhood proved as strong and decisive as any of their predecessors. This certainly seems to have been the case with Dagobert II. Dagobert II was born in 651, heir to the kingdom of Austrasie. On his father's death in 656, Dagobert was kidnapped by the presiding mayor of the palace, an individual named Grimold. Attempts to find the 5-year-old child proved fruitless, and it was not difficult to convince the court that he was dead. Grimold then engineered his own son's acquisition of the throne, claiming this had been the wish of the former monarch. Even Dagobert's mother, believing her son dead, deferred to the ambitious mayor of the palace. Grimold had apparently balked at actually murdering the young prince. Dagobert was therefore consigned to permanent exile in Ireland. He grew into manhood at the Irish monastery of Slane. In 666, probably still in Ireland, Dagobert married Matilde, a Celtic princess. Not long after, he moved from Ireland to England, establishing residence at York in the Kingdom of Northumbria. Here he formed a close friendship with St. Wilfrid, Bishop of York, who became his mentor. During the period in question, a schism still existed between the Roman and Celtic churches, with the latter refusing to acknowledge the former's authority. As a loyal adherent of Rome, Wilfrid was eager to consolidate Roman supremacy, not only in Britain, but on the continent as well. Were Dagobert to return to France and reclaim the kingdom of Austrasie, it would have been expedient to ensure his fealty. Wilfrid may well have seen the exiled king as a future sword arm of the church. In 670, Dagobert's wife died, giving birth to her third daughter. Wilfrid hastened to arrange a new match for the monarch. Dagobert's new wife was Giselle de Razès, daughter of the Count of Razès and niece of the King of the Visigoths. Herein lay the seeds of embryonic empire, which would have united much of modern France, extending from the Pyrenees to the Ardennes. Such an empire, moreover, would have brought the Visigoths firmly under Roman control. When Dagobert married Giselle, he had already returned to the continent. The marriage was celebrated at Giselle's official residence of Redai, or Rennes-le-Château. The marriage was reputedly celebrated in the church of Saint-Madeleine, the structure on the site of which Véranger Saunier's church was subsequently erected. Dagobert's first marriage had produced three daughters. By Giselle, Dagobert had two more daughters, and at last, in 1676, one son, the infant Sigisbert IV. And by the time Sigisbert was born, Dagobert was once more a king. In 1674, with the support of his mother and her advisers, the long-exiled monarch announced himself and was officially proclaimed King of Austrasie. Once restored to the throne, Dagobert proved to be a worthy successor to Clovis. At once he set about asserting and consolidating his authority, taming the anarchy that prevailed throughout Austrasie, and re-establishing order. He ruled firmly, breaking the control of various rebellious nobles who had mobilized sufficient military and economic power to challenge the throne. And at Rennes-le-Château, he is said to have amassed a substantial treasury. At the same time, Dagobert must have been a severe disappointment to Wilfrid of York. If Wilfrid had expected him to be a sword arm of the church, Dagobert proved nothing of the sort. On the contrary, he seems to have curbed attempted expansion of the church within his realm. By 679, after 3 years on the throne, Dagobert had made a number of powerful enemies, both secular and ecclesiastic. One such was the king's own mayor of the palace, Pepin the Fat. Like most Merovingian rulers, Dagobert had at least two capital cities. The most important of these was Stirnay on the fringe of the Ardennes. Near the royal palace at Stirnay stretched a heavily wooded expanse, long deemed sacred, called the Forest of Wervres. It was in this forest, on December the 23rd, 679, that Dagobert is said to have gone hunting. Towards midday, the king lay down to rest beside a stream. While he slept, one of his servants stole up to him, and, acting under Pepin's orders, pierced him with a lance through the eye. The murderers then returned to Stirnay, intent on exterminating the rest of the family in residence there. How successful they were in this latter undertaking is not clear. Immediately after his death, Dagobert was buried at Stirnay in the royal chapel of Saint-Remy. In 872, nearly two centuries later, he was exhumed and moved to another church. This new church became the Church of Saint-Dagobert, for in the same year the dead king was canonized, not by the Pope, who did not claim this right exclusively until 1159, but by a metropolitan conclave. The reason for his canonization remains unclear. Ecclesiastical authorities seem embarrassingly ignorant concerning the matter. They admit that Dagobert became the object of a fully-fledged cult and had his own feast day, December the 23rd, the anniversary of his death, but they seem utterly at a loss as to why he should have been so exalted. During the French Revolution, the church was destroyed and the relics of Saint Dagobert were dispersed. Today, a ritually incised skull, said to be Dagobert's, is in the custody of a convent at Mons. All other relics of the king have disappeared. Strictly speaking, Dagobert was not the last ruler of the Merovingian dynasty. In fact, Merovingian monarchs retained at least nominal status for another three-quarters of a century, but many of them were extremely young. In consequence, they were often weak, helpless pawns in the hands of the mayors of the palace, incapable of asserting their authority or of making decisions of their own. As power seeped from the hands of the Merovingians, it passed into the hands of the mayors of the palace. It was a mayor of the palace, Pepin the Fat, who engineered Dagobert's death, and Pepin the Fat was followed by his son, the famous Charles Martel. Charles Martel is regarded as one of the most heroic figures in French history. Under Charles, the Moorish invasion of France was checked at the Battle of Poitiers in 732, and Charles, by virtue of this victory, was, in some sense, both defender of the faith and saviour of Christendom. What is curious is that Charles Martel, strong man though he was, never seized the throne, which certainly lay within his grasp. Charles Martel died in 741. 10 years later, his son, Pepin III, mayor of the palace to King Childeric III, enlisted the support of the church in laying formal claim to the throne. "Who should be king?" Pepin's ambassadors asked the Pope. "The man who actually holds power, or he, though called king, who has no power at all?" The Pope pronounced in Pepin's favour, a brazen betrayal of the pact ratified with Clovis 2.5 centuries before. Thus endorsed by Rome, Pepin deposed Childeric III, confined the king to a monastery, and had him shorn of his sacred hair. 4 years later, Childeric died, and Pepin's claim to the throne was undisputed. A year before, a crucial document had conveniently made its appearance, which subsequently altered the course of Western history. This document was called the Donation of Constantine. Today, there's no question that it was a forgery concocted within the papal chancery. At the time, however, it was deemed genuine, and its influence was enormous. The Donation of Constantine purported to date from Constantine's conversion to Christianity in AD 312. According to the Donation, Constantine had officially given to the Bishop of Rome his imperial symbols and regalia, which thus became the Church's property. The Donation further alleged that Constantine, for the first time, had declared the Bishop of Rome to be Vicar of Christ, and offered him the status of emperor. According to the Donation of Constantine, the Bishop of Rome exercised supreme secular as well as supreme spiritual authority over Christendom. He was, in effect, a papal emperor who possessed, through Christ, the unchallengeable right to create or depose kings. It is from the Donation of Constantine that the subsequent power of the Vatican in secular affairs ultimately derives. Claiming authority from the Donation of Constantine, the Church devised a ceremony whereby the blood of usurpers, or anyone else for that matter, could be made sacred. This ceremony came to be known as coronation and anointment. At Pepin's coronation, bishops for the first time were authorized to attend, with rank equal to that of secular nobles, and the coronation itself no longer entailed the recognition of a king. It now consisted of nothing less than the creation of a king. The ritual of anointment was similarly transformed. Now it took precedence over blood and could sanctify blood. Anointment became something more than a symbolic gesture. It became the act whereby divine grace was conferred upon a ruler. The Pope, by performing this act, became supreme mediator between God and kings, and all monarchs were rendered ultimately subordinate and subservient to the Pope. In 754, Pepin III was officially anointed at Pontion, thus inaugurating the Carolingian dynasty. The name derives from Charles Martel, although it's generally associated with the most famous of Carolingian rulers, Charles the Great, or, as he's best known, Charlemagne. And in 1800, Charlemagne was proclaimed Holy Roman Emperor. Rome now became the seat of an empire that embraced the whole of Western Europe, whose rulers ruled only with the sanction of the Pope. In 496, the Church had pledged itself in perpetuity to the Merovingian bloodline. In sanctioning the assassination of Dagobert, in devising the ceremonies of coronation and anointment, in endorsing Pepin's claim to the throne, it had clandestinely betrayed its pact. Our inquiries indicated that this betrayal, even though it occurred more than 1,100 years ago, continue to rankle for the Prieuré de Sion. With the death of Childeric III in 755, the Merovingians seemed to vanish from the stage of world history completely. According to the Prieuré documents, however, the Merovingian bloodline survived. According to the Prieuré documents, it was perpetuated to the present day from Sigisbert, Dagobert's son, by his second wife, Giselle de Razes. There is no question that Sigisbert existed and that he was Dagobert's heir. There is no record whatever of Sigisbert's death, nor is there any record, apart from the evidence in the Prieuré documents, of his survival. It is hardly surprising that no account of Sigisbert's fate has filtered down to us. Today, Dagobert II can be found in any encyclopedia. Until 1646, however, there was no acknowledgement whatever that he had ever lived. Any list of French rulers compiled before 1646 simply omits him, jumping from Dagobert I to Dagobert III. Why, we wondered, should Dagobert II have been excised from history? One possibility, of course, is to negate the existence of his heirs. If Dagobert never lived, Sigisbert cannot have lived either. But why deny that Sigisbert had ever lived, unless he had indeed survived and his descendants were still regarded as a threat? But why should the issue have continued to matter as late as the age of Louis XIV? Three French dynasties had come and gone, while Protestantism had broken Roman hegemony. Unless there was indeed something very special about the Merovingian blood, something that retained its explosive potency even after superstitions about magical blood had fallen by the wayside. According to the Prieuré documents, Sigisbert IV, on the death of his father, was rescued by his sister and smuggled southwards to the domain of his mother, the Visigoth princess Giselle de Razes. He is said to have arrived in the Languedoc in 681, and at some point shortly thereafter to have inherited his uncle's titles, Duke of Razes and Count of Reda. He is also said to have adopted the surname or nickname Plantade, subsequently Plantard, from the appellation Rejeton Ardent, ardently flowering shoot of the Merovingian vine. Under this name, and under the titles acquired from his uncle, he is said to have perpetuated his lineage, and by 886, one branch of that lineage is said to have culminated in a certain Bernard Plantavelu, whose son became the first Duke of Aquitaine. By 742, there was an independent and fully autonomous state in the south of France, a princedom, according to some accounts, a fully-fledged kingdom, according to others. It was officially recognized by Charlemagne and his successors, and by the Caliph of Baghdad, and the Islamic world. It was grudgingly recognized by the Church, some of whose lands it confiscated. And it survived until the late 9th century. Sometime between 759 and 768, the ruler of this state, which included the Razes and Rennes-le-Château, was officially pronounced a king. He was recognized as such by the Carolingians, to whom he pledged himself as vassal. In existing accounts, he figures most frequently under the name of Theodoric, or Thierry, and most modern scholars regard him as being of Merovingian descent. There is no definitive evidence from where such descent might have derived. It might well have derived from Sigisbert. In any case, there is no question that by 790, Theodoric's son, Guillaume de Jolone, held the title of Count of Razes. The title Sigisbert is said to have possessed and passed on to his descendants. Guillaume de Jolone was one of the most famous men of his time, so much so, indeed, that his historical reality, like that of Charlemagne and Godfrey de Bouillon, has been obscured by legend. Before the epoch of the Crusades, there were at least six major epic poems composed about him, Chansons de Geste, similar to the famous Chansons de Roland. Guillaume maintained a close rapport with Charlemagne. His sister was married to one of Charlemagne's sons, thus establishing a dynastic link with the imperial blood. And Guillaume himself was one of Charlemagne's most important commanders in the incessant warfare against the Moors. In 803, shortly after Charlemagne's coronation as Holy Roman Emperor, Guillaume captured Barcelona, doubling his own territory and extending his influence across the Pyrenees. Independent authorities have provided detailed genealogies of Guillaume de Jolone's line, his family and descendants. By 886, the line of Guillaume de Jolone culminated in a certain Bernard Plantavelu, who established the Duchy of Aquitaine. In other words, Guillaume's line culminated in precisely the same individual as the line ascribed by the Prieuré documents to Sigismund IV and his descendants. We were tempted, of course, to jump to conclusions and use the genealogies in the Prieuré documents to bridge the gap left by accepted history. We were tempted to assume that the elusive progenitors of Guillaume de Jolone were Sigismund IV and the main line of the deposed Merovingian dynasty, the line cited in the Prieuré documents under the name Plantade or Plantard. Unfortunately, we could not do so. Given the confused state of existing records, we cannot definitively establish the precise connection between the Plantard line and the line of Guillaume de Jolone. They might indeed have been one and the same. On the other hand, they might have intermarried at some point. What remained certain, however, was that both lines, by 886, had culminated in Bernard Plantavelu and the Dukes of Aquitaine. Although they didn't always match precisely in dating and translation of names, the genealogies connected with Guillaume de Jolone did constitute a certain independent confirmation for the genealogies in the Prieuré documents. We could thus tentatively accept, in the absence of any contradictory evidence, that the Merovingian bloodline did continue, more or less, as the Prieuré documents maintained. We could tentatively accept that Sigismund did survive his father's murder, did adopt the family name of Plantard, and, as Count of Razes, did perpetuate his father's lineage. The Middle Ages abound with a mythology as rich and resonant as those of ancient Greece and Rome. Among the most popular and evocative of medieval myths is that of Lohengrin, the Swan Knight. According to medieval accounts, Lohengrin was a scion of the elusive and mysterious Grail family. One day in the sacred temple or castle of the Grail at Munzelwasche, Lohengrin is said to have heard the chapel bell tolling without the intervention of human hands, a signal that his aid was urgently required somewhere in the world. It was required, predictably enough, by a damsel in distress, the Duchess of Brabant, according to some sources, the Duchess of Bouillon, according to others. The lady desperately needed a champion, and Lohengrin hastened to rescue her in a boat drawn by heraldic swans. In single combat, he defeated the Duchess's persecutor, then married the lady. At their nuptials, however, he issued a stringent warning. Never was his bride to query him about his origins or ancestry, his background or the place whence he came. And for some years the lady obeyed her husband's edict. At last, however, she presumed to ask the forbidden question. Lohengrin was compelled to depart, vanishing in his swan-drawn boat into the sunset. And behind him, with his wife, he left a child. According to various accounts, this child was either the father or the grandfather of Godefroy de Bouillon. It's difficult for the modern mind to appreciate the magnitude of Godefroy's status in popular consciousness, not only in his own time, but even as late as the 17th century. Today, when one thinks of the Crusades, one thinks of Richard Coeur de Lion, King John, or Frederick Barbarossa. But until relatively recently, none of these individuals enjoyed Godefroy's prestige or acclaim. It was Godefroy who inaugurated the Crusades. It was Godefroy who captured Jerusalem from the Saracens. It was Godefroy who rescued Christ's sepulchre from infidel hands. It was Godefroy, above all others, who reconciled the ideals of high chivalric enterprise and fervent Christian piety. Not surprisingly, therefore, Godefroy became the object of a cult which persisted long after his death. The Prieuré documents furnished us with the most plausible, perhaps indeed the first plausible, genealogy of Godefroy de Bouillon that has yet come to light. As far as this genealogy could be checked, it proved accurate. We found no evidence to contradict it, much to support it, and it convincingly bridged a number of perplexing historical gaps. According to the genealogy in the Prieuré documents, Godefroy de Bouillon was a lineal descendant of the Plantard family. In other words, Godefroy was of Merovingian blood, directly descended from Dagobert II, Sigismund IV, and the line of Merovingian lost kings. This revelation cast a significant new light on the Crusades. We could now perceive the Crusades from a new perspective, and discern in them something more than the symbolic gesture of reclaiming Christ's sepulchre from the Saracens. In his own eyes, as well as those of his supporters, Godefroy would have been more than Duke of Lorraine. He would, in fact, have been a rightful king, a legitimate claimant of a dynasty deposed with Dagobert II in 679. But if Godefroy was a rightful king, he was also a king without a kingdom. The Capetian dynasty in France was by then too well entrenched to be dethroned. What can one do if one is a king without a kingdom? Perhaps find a kingdom, or create a kingdom. The most precious kingdom in the entire world, Palestine, the Holy Land, the soil trodden by Jesus himself. Would not the ruler of such a kingdom be comparable to any in Europe? And would he not, in presiding over that most sacred of earthly sites, obtain sweet revenge on the church which betrayed his ancestors 4 centuries before? Gradually, certain pieces of the puzzle were beginning to fall into place. If Godefroy was of Merovingian blood, a number of seemingly disconnected fragments ceased to be disconnected and assumed a coherent continuity. We could thus explain the emphasis accorded such apparently disparate elements as the Merovingian dynasty and the Crusades, Dagobert II and Godefroy, Rennes-le-Château, the Knights Templar, the House of Lorraine, the Prieuré de Sion. We could even trace the Merovingian bloodlines up to the present day, to Alain Poher, to Henri de Montpezat, consort of the Queen of Denmark, to Pierre Plantard de St. Clair, to Otto von Habsburg, titular Duke of Lorraine and King of Jerusalem. And yet the really crucial question continued to elude us. We still could not see why the Merovingian bloodline should be so inexplicably important today. We still couldn't see why its claim should be in any way relevant to contemporary affairs, or why it should command the allegiance of so many distinguished men through the centuries. We still could not see why a modern Merovingian monarchy, however technically legitimate it might be, warranted such urgent endorsement. Quite clearly, we were overlooking something. Once again, we sifted through the compilation of Prieuré documents, the dossier secret. We reread passages which had meant nothing to us before. Now they made sense, but they didn't serve to explain the mystery nor to answer what had now become the critical questions. On the other hand, there were other passages whose relevance was still unclear to us. These passages by no means resolved the enigma, but they set us thinking along certain lines. Lines which eventually proved to be of paramount significance. Among the genealogies and the dossier secrets, there were numerous footnotes and annotations. Many of these referred specifically to one of the 12 tribes of ancient Israel, the tribe of Benjamin. One such reference cites and emphasizes 3 biblical passages. Deuteronomy, chapter 33, verse 12, contains the blessing pronounced by Moses on the patriarchs of each of the 12 tribes. Of Benjamin, Moses says, "The beloved of the Lord shall dwell in safety by him, and the Lord shall cover him all the day long, and he shall dwell between his shoulders." In other words, Benjamin and his descendants were singled out for a very special and exalted blessing. That much, at any rate, was clear. We were, of course, puzzled by the promise of the Lord dwelling between Benjamin's shoulders. Should we associate it with the legendary Merovingian birthmark, the red cross between the shoulders? The connection seemed somewhat far-fetched. On the other hand, there were other clearer similarities between Benjamin in the Old Testament and the subject of our investigation. According to Robert Graves, for example, the day sacred to Benjamin was December the 23rd, Dagobert's feast day. The second biblical reference in the dossier's secrets is rather more clear. It deals with the arrival of Moses' people in the Promised Land and the apportionment to each of the 12 tribes of particular tracts of territory. According to Joshua, chapter 18, verse 28, the birthright of the Benjamites encompassed Zelah, Eleph, and Jebusi, which is Jerusalem, Jebith, and Kerjath. 14 cities with their villages. This is the inheritance of the children of Benjamin according to their families. The third biblical passage cited by the Dossier's Secrets involves a fairly complex sequence of events. A Levite travelling through Benjamite territory is assaulted and his concubine ravished by worshippers of Belial, a variant of the Sumerian mother goddess. Calling representatives of the 12 tribes to witness, the Levite demands vengeance for the atrocity, and at a council, the Benjamites are instructed to deliver the malefactors to justice. One might expect the Benjamites to comply readily. For some reason, however, they do not, and undertake by force of arms to protect the sons of Belial. The result is a bitter and bloody war between the Benjamites and the remaining 11 tribes. In the course of hostilities, a curse is pronounced by the latter on any man who gives his daughter to a Benjamite. When the war is over, however, and the Benjamites virtually exterminated, the victorious Israelites repent of their malediction, which, however, cannot be retracted. Now the men of Israel had sworn in Mizpeh, saying, "There shall not any of us give his daughter unto Benjamin to wife." And the people came to the house of God, and abode there till even before God, and lifted up their voices, and wept sore, and said, "O Lord God of Israel, why is this come to pass in Israel, that there should be today one tribe lacking in Israel?" Judges chapter 21, verses 1 through 3. A few verses later, the lament is repeated. "And the children of Israel repented them for Benjamin their brother, and said, 'There is one tribe cut off from Israel this day. How shall we do for wives for them that remain, seeing we have sworn by the Lord that we will not give them of our daughters to wives?'" Judges chapter 21, verses 6 through 7. And yet again, "And the people repented them for Benjamin, because that the Lord had made a breach in the tribes of Israel. Then the elders of the congregation said, 'How shall we do for wives for them that remain, seeing the women are destroyed out of Benjamin?' And they said, 'There must be an inheritance for them that escaped out of Benjamin, that a tribe be not destroyed out of Israel. Howbeit we may not give them wives of our daughters, for the children of Israel have sworn, saying, Cursed be he that giveth a wife to Benjamin.'" Judges chapter 21, verses 15 through 18. Confronted by the possible extinction of an entire tribe, the elders quickly devise a solution. At Shiloh in Bethel, there is to be a festival shortly, and the women of Shiloh, whose menfolk had remained neutral in the war, are to be considered fair game. The surviving Benjamites are instructed to go to Shiloh and wait in ambush in the vineyards. When the women of the town congregate to dance in the forthcoming festival, the Benjamites are to pounce upon them and take them to wife. It's not at all clear why the Dossier Secret insist on calling attention to this passage, but whatever the reason, the Benjamites, so far as biblical history is concerned, are clearly important. Despite the devastation of the war, they quickly recover in prestige, if not in numbers. Indeed, they recover so well that in 1 Samuel they furnish Israel with her first king, Saul. Whatever recovery the Benjamites may have made, however, the Dossier's Secrets implied that the war over the followers of Belial was a crucial turning point. It would seem that in the wake of this conflict, many, if not most, Benjamites went into exile. There is a note in the Dossier Secret in capital letters. "One day the descendants of Benjamin left their country. Certain remained. 2,000 years later, Godefroy VI de Bouillon became king of Jerusalem and founded the Order de Sion." At first there appeared to be no connection between these apparent non sequiturs. When we assembled the diverse and fragmentary references in the Dossier Secrets, however, a coherent story began to emerge. According to this account, most Benjamites did go into exile. Their exile supposedly took them to Greece, to the central Peloponnese, to Arcadia, where they supposedly became aligned with the Arcadian royal line. Towards the advent of the Christian era, they are then said to have migrated up the Danube and the Rhine, intermarrying with certain Teutonic tribes, and eventually engendering the Sicambrian Franks, the immediate forebears of the Merovingians. According to the Prurie documents, then, the Merovingians were descended, via Arcadia, from the tribe of Benjamin, In other words, the Merovingians were ultimately of Semitic or Israelite origin, and if Jerusalem was indeed the hereditary birthright of the Benjamites, Godefroy de Bouillon, in marching on the holy city, would in fact have been reclaiming his ancient and rightful heritage. Needless to say, we had no way of ascertaining whether the Merovingians were of Benjamite origin or not, but the assertions were neither particularly unique nor particularly new. In fact, the argument, although unprovable, is not altogether implausible, nor are the exile and migration ascribed to the tribe of Benjamin in the priori documents. Following their war against the other 11 tribes of Israel, Benjamites fleeing into exile would of necessity have had to flee westwards towards the Phoenician coast. The Phoenicians possessed ships capable of transporting large numbers of refugees, and they would have been obvious allies for fugitive Benjamites, for they, too, worshipped the mother goddess in the form of Astarte, Queen of Heaven. If there was actually an exodus of Benjamites from Palestine, one might hope to find some vestigial record of it. In Greek myth, one does. There is the legend of King Belus's son, one Danaus, who arrives in Greece with his daughters by ship. His daughters are said to have introduced the cult of the mother goddess, which became the established cult of the Arcadians. According to Robert Graves, the Danaus myth records the arrival in the Peloponnese of colonists from Palestine. There is other evidence, apart from mythology, suggesting a Judaic migration to Arcadia. In classical times, the region known as Arcadia was ruled by the powerful militaristic state of Sparta. On reaching manhood, the Spartans, like the Merovingians, ascribed a special magical significance to their hair, which, like the Merovingians, they wore long. According to one authority, the length of hair denoted their physical vigor and became a sacred symbol. What is more, both books of Maccabees in the Apocrypha stress the link between Spartans and Jews. Maccabees 1 states explicitly, "It has been found in writing concerning the Spartans and the Jews that they are brethren and are of the family of Abraham." We could thus acknowledge at least the possibility of a Judaic migration to Arcadia. As for Semitic influence on Frankish culture, there was solid archaeological evidence. As early as 700 to 800 BC, there were Phoenician settlements not only along the French coast, but inland as well. Among the artifacts found at these sites were many of Semitic origin. Again, then, while we could not prove the claims in the priori documents, we could not discount them either. We were compelled to acknowledge that the priori documents might be correct, that the Merovingians and the various noble families descended from them might have stemmed from Semitic sources. But could this really be all there was to the story? Could this really be the portentous secret which had engendered so much controversy and conflict through the centuries? Could it really explain the motivation of the Priori de Sion and the claim of the Merovingian dynasty? Why should the descent from the tribe of Benjamin constitute so explosive a secret? And perhaps, most crucially, why should descent from the tribe of Benjamin matter today? If our inquiry involved vested interests that were specifically Semitic or Judaic, why did it involve so many components of a specifically Christian character? The pact between Clovis and the Roman Church, for example, the avowed Christianity of Godefroy de Bouillon, and the conquest of Jerusalem, and the implication of so many Christian ecclesiastics, from high-ranking princes of the church to local village curés like Boudet and Sonnière. It might be that the Merovingians were ultimately of Judaic origin. But if this were so, it seemed to us essentially incidental. Whatever the real secret underlying our investigation, it appeared to be inextricably associated not with Old Testament Judaism, but with Christianity. The tribe of Benjamin, for the moment at least, seemed to be a red herring. However important it might be, there was something of even greater importance involved. We were still overlooking something. Part 3. The Bloodline. What might we have been overlooking? As far as we could determine, we had overlooked no item, no data of accepted historical scholarship. But might there be something else, something that lay beyond the pale of documented history, the concrete facts to which we had endeavoured to confine ourselves? Certainly, there was one motif, admittedly fabulous, which had threaded itself through our investigation, recurring repeatedly with insistent and intriguing consistency. This was the mysterious object known as the Holy Grail. By their contemporaries, for example, the Cathars were believed to have been in possession of the Grail. The Templars, too, were often regarded as the Grail's custodians, and the Grail romances had originally issued from the court of the Count of Champagne, who was intimately associated with the foundation of the Knights Templar. When the Templars were suppressed, moreover, the bizarre heads they supposedly worshipped enjoyed, according to the official Inquisition reports, many of the attributes traditionally ascribed to the Grail, providing sustenance, for example, and imbuing the land with fertility. In the course of our investigation, we had run across the Grail in numerous other contexts as well. Were these intrusions of the Grail into our inquiry merely random and coincidental, or was there a continuity underlying and connecting them, a continuity which in some unimaginable way did link our inquiry to the Grail, whatever the Grail might really be? At this point, we were confronted by a staggering question. Could the Grail be something more than pure fantasy? Could there have really been such a thing as the Holy Grail? It is generally assumed that the Holy Grail relates in some way to Jesus. According to some traditions, it was the cup from which Jesus and his disciples drank at the Last Supper. According to other traditions, it was the cup in which Joseph of Arimathea caught Jesus' blood as he hung on the cross. According to other traditions still, the Grail was both of these. But if the Grail was so intimately associated with Jesus, or if it did indeed exist, why was there no reference to it whatever for more than 1,000 years? Why should something of such intense relevance and immediacy to Christendom remain buried for as long as it apparently did? More provocatively still, why should the Grail finally surface precisely when it did, at the very peak of the Crusades? Was it coincidence that this enigmatic object, ostensibly non-existent for 10 centuries, should assume the status it did at the very time it did, when the Frankish kingdom of Jerusalem was in its full glory, when the Templars were at the apex of their power, when the Cathar heresy was gaining a momentum which actually threatened to displace the creed of Rome? Was this convergence of circumstances truly coincidental, or was there some link between them? Somewhat daunted by questions of this kind, we turned our attention to the Grail romances. Only by examining these fantasies closely could we hope to determine whether their recurrence in our inquiry was indeed coincidental, or the manifestation of a pattern which might in some way prove significant. The pagan foundation for the Grail romances has been exhaustively explored by scholars, from Sir James Fraser in The Golden Bough up to the present. But during the mid to late 12th century, the originally pagan foundation for the Grail romances underwent a curious and extremely important transformation. In some obscure way that has eluded the investigation of researchers, the Grail became very uniquely and specifically associated with Christianity, and with a rather unorthodox form of Christianity at that. As a relic linked mystically with Jesus, the Grail engendered a voluminous quantity of romances or lengthy narrative poems, which even today tease the imagination. Despite clerical disapprobation, these romances flourished for nearly a century, becoming a fully-fledged cult of their own. With the fall of the Holy Land in 1291 and the dissolution of the Templars between 1307 and 1314, the Grail romances also vanished from the stage of history, for another 2 centuries or so at any rate. Then in 1470, the theme was taken up again by Sir Thomas Malory in his famous La Morte d'Arthur, and it has remained more or less prominent in Western culture ever since. By Malory's time, the mysterious object known as the Grail had assumed the more or less distinct identity ascribed to it today. It was alleged to be the cup of the Last Supper, in which Joseph of Arimathea later caught Jesus' blood. According to certain accounts, the Grail was brought by Joseph of Arimathea to England, more specifically to Glastonbury. According to other accounts, it was brought by the Magdalene to France. As early as the 4th century, legends describe the Magdalene fleeing the Holy Land and being set ashore near Marseille, where, for that matter, her purported relics are still venerated. But the early legends say that the Magdalene brought the Grail into France, not a cup. In these original sources, the Grail is something much more than a cup. In the opinion of most scholars, the first genuine Grail romance dates from the late 12th century, from around 1188, that crucial year which witnessed the fall of Jerusalem and the alleged rupture between the Order of the Temple and the Prieuré de Sion. The romance in question is entitled Le Roman de Perceval, or Le Conte du Graal. It was composed by one Chrétien de Troyes, who seemed to have been attached in some indeterminate capacity to the court of the Count of Champagne. Chrétien's Grail romance was dedicated to Philippe d'Alsace, Count of Flanders. At the beginning of his poem, Chrétien declares that his work has been composed specifically at Philippe's request, and that it was from Philippe that he heard the story in the first place. The work itself furnishes a general pattern for subsequent Grail narratives. Its protagonist is named Perceval, who is described as the son of the widow lady. This appellation had long been employed by certain of the dualist and Gnostic heresies, sometimes for their own prophets, sometimes for Jesus himself. Subsequently, it became a cherished designation in Freemasonry. Leaving his widowed mother, Perceval sallies forth to win his knighthood. During his travels, he comes upon an enigmatic fisherman, the famous Fisher King, in whose castle